This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome to the 30th Annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson on the journalism faculty at the university, and we are overjoyed to have Mitch Albom with us. He's one of the most celebrated and versatile writers you'll ever encounter. His sports writing has won awards for decades, and so have his novels. Many of them have been made into movies. He's best known for his books, Tuesdays with Maury, and his other titles include The Little Liar, Five People You Meet in Heaven, Finding Chica, and several others. He's also a songwriter, runs several nonprofit organizations, and is a champion for humanitarian and spiritual efforts. Mitch Albom, welcome to our Writer Symposium.
Thank you.
There you go.
You know, this chair reminded me of something. When Tuesdays with Maury came out, I got asked to do the Oprah Winfrey show. And I'd never really done anything like that before. And I went to Chicago and to do the show, and they, you know, you don't get to talk to Oprah or anything, but ahead of time, it's all done in real time. And you don't get out on stage, you don't know what's coming. So I'm standing in the back, and they're backstage like there, and they're saying, okay, as soon as you hear your name, you go out, you sit down, you know, you look over and Oprah, and they'll start talking, okay, ready, go, and they push you out. So I go walking across the stage, and I see Oprah, and there's this chair, and I don't know how many of you remember the Oprah program when it was on, but she doesn't have, like, human being furniture. She has, like, Gulliver's furniture, you know, like, everything is massive. And as you could see by my walking, I'm not the world's tallest human being. And I come out, and I get into this chair, and my feet do not touch the ground. And so all of a sudden, I have like one purpose in life is to get, you know, down low enough that my feet are. And I just didn't want to look like Edith Ann from Laugh-In, you know, that little girl in the chair. And I just spent the whole time, you know, just wiggling there. And I was only on for 5 minutes. And I honestly do not remember a single thing that she asked me. But I do know that after 5 minutes, I sweated through my suit. That's not easy to do in 5 minutes. I had sweat stains on the outside of my suit, and I interviewed, the show ended, the interview ended, the lights went off, and I left the chair, I parachuted to the ground, you know. And I was walking off the stage feeling total failure, and Oprah Winfrey says to me, oh, hey, by the way, and I turn around, she says, I'd like to make a movie out of this book, would that be okay? And I said, okay. And so this chair, when I got in it, I said, oh my God, not again, you know, but it's not that high.
Yeah, are you comfortable now?
I'm good, sorry okay. about that yeah, deviation, yeah. but
Just in case you're wondering, there are no movies in the offing after this. We
okay,
just don't know.
Not a prerequisite.
No. So I love the fact that you didn't start out in journalism. You started out as a musician. Yeah. You were singing in clubs and doing Elvis impersonations and all of that stuff. Did you think journalism would be more respectable than that when you made the move?
I wasn't at that age. Respectable really wasn't on my mind. I was just trying to eat, but. I didn't do Elvis impressions in New York. I lived in Greece and worked at I got a job being a piano player and a singer in the island of Crete, and Agios Nikolaos, a little fishing village that was so far back. Now it's kind of built up, but back then it was so remote that they hired me to sing like American songs, and I started doing like some Elvis Presley songs, and I think they thought they were originals. You know, that's how far yeah. away this was.
Wow, hound dog. Yeah. Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. So it was an unbelievable job. And I played piano for like 45 minutes in the lounge. And then I'd go in and sing with the band. And all the other you know, music was Greek music. And so, you know, like that kind of thing. And so all of a sudden I come on and I'm doing like one for the money, two for the, and they're like, and I was a big hit, you know, because like I say, they hadn't seen anything like that yet there. And I should have stayed there my whole life because I had a bungalow on the ocean, on the Aegean Sea. They paid me in cash every Monday morning. They just handed it over. And like a fool, I left that to come back to New York City to starve as a musician. And whenever I would like interview guys to be in bands, they would all say like, man, one day I hope I can like find an island where I can play somewhere, you know. And I was like, yeah, I did that. But yeah, I was a musician in New York, and I'd never written anything. And I had told some of your students here today, which by the way, this is just a fantastic school that you have here and program that you have. I've met so many interesting and interested young people who are interested in the craft of writing, and it's inspirational to see because we're at a point where writing is at a very precarious position right now. You know, we could lose our writing talents to computers, and so to see people who are into it is really great. But I had never had any formal education in writing at all. I never took a writing class. I never had a writing professor. All during college, I wanted to be a musician, and if you read Tuesdays with Maury, I basically majored in sociology because of Maury Schwartz. So I was a musician and living in New York, and I wasn't doing particularly well, and I happened to be in a supermarket, and I picked up a little freebie newspaper that they would throw in your basket. It came out once a week, and this was in Queens, New York, and it said at the bottom, if you have spare time, we could use some volunteers at the newspaper because, you know, help us put it out. So I worked mostly at nights and clubs and things like that, so I had time during the day. So I went to the newspaper, walked in there, and I was like the youngest person by 60 years, you know. And they gave me an assignment that day to go out that night and write a story about it. It was a meeting, like a little local meeting about the parking meters on 108th Street in New York. They're gonna raise the parking meters from 5 cents to 10 cents. Go write a story.
Breaking news.
Yeah, big news, yeah. You know. You need that nickel. And so I went out there having never written anything. My entire exposure to journalism was having watched All the President's Men, you know. And so I went there, I did what they did, you know. I went with a pad and I asked some really tough questions, you know. Why are you raising them to 10 cents? And then, you know, but I read a lot. And this is what I always tell young people is you want to be a writer, you better first read. You know, you want to be a good musician, you can't, you know, just pick up an instrument not having listened to music before. So I read a lot and I read newspapers. And so I kind of knew how it looked. You know, you write the first paragraph, kind of sums up everything. And second paragraph has a quote. And then the third paragraph kind of, you know, opens it up. I didn't even realize I was sort of doing that pyramid that they teach you. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote the story about parking meters, and the next week when I went to the supermarket, picked up that same paper, and there was my story on the bottom of the front page, which only goes to show you how little news happened that week in New York. But it had my name on it, and I got that little tingle that mm-hmm. you get, you know, when mm-hmm. you create something that has your name on it, and I say I became a writer that week, that morning in the supermarket.
That's awesome. And I love the fact that music has stayed part of what you do. I mean, you've written some songs. You wrote a song for an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Yeah, it doesn't sound as good when you say it that way. But
but I've heard it, and it's good.
My wife is singing on it. I've written, I didn't have any success when I was trying to be a musician. But I've had some success when I wasn't, you know. Once you become a writer and you're not you know, it's that thing that writers want to be musicians, musicians want to be writers, athletes want to be rappers, rappers want to be athletes, you know, everybody wants to be something else. So once I became a writer and got some notoriety, I started meeting a lot of musicians, and I ended up getting opportunities. Warren Zevon, I play in this band of writers, which is, we're really terrible, but
tell us the name of it.
The Rock Bottom Remainders, which is, you know, what you call a book when you can't discount it anymore, you know, when it's down to like 49 cents and it's in the bin outside the store. They don't care if it gets rained on or whatever. It doesn't matter. That's a rock bottom remainder. And I've been in this band for about 20, since 1994, whatever that is. Almost, that's like 30 years, isn't it? And Stephen King, Amy Tan, Dave Barry, Ridley Pearson, Scott Turow, James McBride. There's a bunch of others. I mean, pretty much anybody who walks on stage can be in this band. But those guys are the kind of core of it. And through that, I met a lot of musicians. Warren Zevon toured with us for several years. He and I became good friends. I wrote a song that he recorded.
The hockey song.
Yeah, yeah. That became a single in Canada, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so I've had some weird success in the movie song and stuff like that. But only when I stopped trying to be a musician did anything come my way as a musician.
So I know you did sports writing early on, but that wasn't even a choice. Didn't you just respond to an ad for that too?
Total accident. And as I told some of your kids earlier today, you know, I'm sort of living proof of that old John Lennon expression, life is what happens to you while you're busy making plans, you know? And my plans, even when I went into writing, I wanted to be a feature writer. I wanted to write for Sunday magazines. You know, at the time, they were still the New York Times and all. They had these big Sunday magazines, and pretty much every newspaper in the country had one. And I wanted to write those Tom Wolfe kind of pieces, those big, long, you know, examining American society. But while I had gone back to graduate school at Columbia to get a master's degree, and I worked my way through it by playing piano at night in these, like, little dive bars, and then I had to get up at 6 in the morning to go to classes and stuff. And while I was there, I needed money, and they had a job on the job board at Sport Magazine. So I went to Sport Magazine, and I worked there, and I got paid a little bit, and I would write little sports pieces for them, you know, just small stuff. So when I graduated, I started applying for jobs. You know how it works in journalism, you have to send your clips. Well, all of my clips were sports stories. But I kept thinking they'll see through them, and they'll see that I can write and whatever. So I applied to this ad in Editor and Publisher, which you remember that magazine.
Yeah.
And it was for a Southeastern Daily Sunday magazine writer job. So I send my stuff, I say, this is it, I'm gonna get this. You know, well, 2 months go by, nothing. And I'm over in Finland at the World Track and Field Championships on a freelance assignment for Track and Field News. And my phone rings, and I pick it up, and I hear that kind of scratchy, you know, because it's long distance. And I hear, is this Mitch Albom? It's a guy with like a thick Boston accent. I said, yeah. He said, this is Fred Turner. I'm the sports editor with the Fort Lauderdale News and Sun Sentinel. I said, okay. He said, you know that Sunday magazine job you applied for? I said, yeah. You didn't get it. I said, you're calling me all the way over here? And tell me I didn't get a job? He said, well, the guy who was doing that job, he saw your clips and he saw they were sports. He brought them over to me and I read them and they're pretty good. So if you want a job in sports, I got one for you. And I flew home, went down to Fort Lauderdale and became a sports writer, totally by accident. And was a sports writer I still do it. You know, I still write a sports column for the Detroit Free Press.
It's a wonderful
that doesn't really warrant clapping, but thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a great career trajectory. And then, of course, Tuesdays with Maury changed the trajectory again.
Yeah.
So that got you into some deeper themes that weren't necessarily about sports.
Well, weren't at all.
Yeah.
You know, I was a sports writer, and by that point in my career, I was 37 when I saw Maury, and I had had, you know, very blessedly, a lot of success in sports young. Not only as a sports writer, I had gotten a lot of attention and awards, but I got on the sports reporters on ESPN, which was a Sunday morning show. And I was on television, national television, you know, pretty much every Sunday for years. Of course, all of this is what made me so busy that I didn't have time to contact my old professor for 16 years from the time I graduated. And I only happened to see him on television one night talking to Ted Koppel about what it was like to die from Lou Gehrig's disease. And that was this accidental, again, life happens when you're making plans, and this accidental flipping of the remote control. And I saw this man who had meant so much to me and now was dying, and I flew out to spend what was going to be one day with him, and one turned to the next week, and the next week it turned out to be all the Tuesdays Maury had left in his life. I told your group earlier today that that book was only written to pay Maury's medical bills. I never went there with the intention of writing a book. In fact, the thought never occurred to me until about more than halfway through all of our visits, and when he told me how in debt he was for his medical bills and how he couldn't pay them and that he was going to die twice. Once when he died, and then once wherever he went next when he realized his family had to sell their house and mortgage everything to pay his bills. And so I got the idea that maybe I could help him, by writing a book, because that was all I knew how to do. I never even told Maury, because I didn't want him to be disappointed, you know, if I couldn't do it. But meanwhile, I started in those last months, I started to go into New York and go around to different publishers and ask them if, you know, they would be interested in this book about an old man talking to a young man about what's important in life once he knows he's going to die. And, you know, I was very passionate in these meetings and, you know, I'm really learning so much and I really think it's good. And everybody said no. It's boring. You're a sports writer. What do you know about this? One publisher actually stopped me in the middle before I could even finish. And he said, look, we're not going to publish this. And look, you don't even know, quite frankly, what a memoir is. Come back in maybe 20 years and you'll understand what a memoir is. That's what they actually said to me. And so, you know, I didn't hardly expect that it would ever get published. And we found one publisher 3 weeks before Maury died who was willing to do it. And I said, you have to give us the money up front because I want to be able to give it to him while he's alive. I just need enough to pay his bills. And that's exactly what they gave us. And I went to Maury and told him, and he cried, which was kind of typical for Maury. And I always thought that that was kind of the end of Tuesdays with Maury. And interestingly, I didn't tell your group this, and I know not very few people know this, but Maury realized that he didn't know he had 3 weeks left to live, but he knew he was getting close to the end. So I said, I wish you could talk to these people because, you know, you're not going to get to meet them, and I wish they could meet you, you know. And he said, well, you have the tape recorder. He said, why don't you, we'll send them a message. I said, okay. Great, you know, he said, go ahead. And I said, don't you want to, like, rehearse? And he said, at this age, I don't rehearse. I said, all right. So I pressed the play and record, and I'm paraphrasing now, but he pretty much said, hello, good people of Doubleday. This is Maury Schwartz, and thank you for publishing this book. Mitch and I will make this beautiful symphony together. I'll give the words and he'll write the music and it'll be wonderful. Now, I won't be there to see it when it comes out, but I want you to know wherever I am, I'll be watching. And I said, perfect, click, you know. And I sent that to him, and yeah. I always think that, you know, they listen to it and they all comment, and I always thought that gave them a little bit of a, like, guilt and conscience about how they had to make sure that they published it. So that's how that happened. But that was a total accident. And I planned on going back to sports writing.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, I remember, he doesn't like that I tell this story, but my literary agent, just before the book came out, they only printed 20,000 copies.
How many is it sold now?
Over 20 million. Maybe
it's the best-selling memoir in history.
To the guy who said it would never be a memoir, it's the best-selling memoir of all time. But I remember when they printed 20,000 copies, and we all thought they'd be, you know, I'd have them in the trunk of my car for the rest of my life and give them out at Christmas to everybody. But I said to my literary agent about 2 weeks before it came out, I said, do you think this is going to hurt my sports writing career? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, it's kind of emotional, and, you know, what if I walk into a locker room and some guy says, oh, I heard about that book, you cried at the end, oh, you know, they start making fun of you. And he said to me, I wouldn't worry about it. Nobody's going to read it. Now, it's my literary agent, so.
Yeah, what a fan club you had.
Yeah.
Wow. But after that comes out, it just seems, as I've read your stuff, something shifted in you about values and what's important, and And even your sports columns, it seemed like you started to get angry about things like hypocrisy and greed and divas and all of that. It just, would you agree that something shifted as a result of that?
Yeah, well, what happened, Dean, is it's this. It's that when you're well known for one thing, it can kind of surround you, you know, and become your world. And so when I was in sports, you know, anytime I would like go through an airport or whatever, people would recognize me from television and they'd say, hey, you know, a sports guy, you know, who's going to win the Super Bowl? Mm-hmm. And you'd just go Patriots because they were winning every Super Bowl. And Patriots, and you just kind of go up the escalator, you know, and keep going. And then after Tuesdays with Maury started to get a following, people would stop me again in airports, but this time they would say, like, my mother died from cancer, and the last thing we did was read your book together. Can I talk to you? And you can't say Patriots and go up the escalator. So I began to talk to tens and hundreds and thousands of people who were grieving. And every time I would go out and do an event like this or a book signing or something, every person who comes up in line, my mother died from cancer, my father died from ALS, and I would start to hear all these stories of people and the grief that they walk around with and what they're dealing with. And when that becomes your world, you become sensitive to that. You look at that, and then other things start to seem kind of silly, including sports, you know, and entertainment and things like that. So, I mean, you have to balance it, and you don't want to walk around angry. That's no way to go through life. But I definitely became more sensitized to, you know, the things that really matter in life and the places that I got asked to speak and visit and go to hospice organizations and you know, meet with a lot of patients. You start to realize, you know, the needs of the world. And then as time passed and I started charities and that became a big thing in Detroit. I worked a lot with the homeless and I spent years doing that. And then 2010, I got involved in Haiti and ended up taking over an orphanage, which is a story and I'll tell it if you want. But anyhow, I've been with that since 2010, pretty much every month of my life until the last couple when the gangs took over in Haiti, you know, and when you're with starving children and children who have been abandoned and left to die and you're responsible for taking care of them, your focus is going to shift. The things you're going to talk about, the things you're going to write about it gets into your bloodstream. And so, yeah, I think you're right in saying that sort of turned, and I'm sure Maury would be very happy about that, you know, that he kind of turned the tide away from touchdowns and a little bit more towards, you know, more important things.
But even the sports stuff, I think there was this shift in the kinds of things you were drawn to, the kinds of stories you were telling. I mean, how intimidating was it when you called out one of these divas, I think it was the Detroit Tigers, who in the locker room, he ended up dumping a cooler of water on you after that. You know, were you a little intimidated by that, by the way?
Well, somebody throws a bucket of ice water on your head, it's, you know, you're not so much as intimidated as you are frozen, you know. But he was an idiot. I mean.
Okay, all right, as long as we're clear.
He almost can't take it seriously. You know, I don't even want to bother telling you why he threw a bucket of water on me. What was sad was that the team didn't defend me. You know, like Sparky Anderson, who I like, but he was the manager, and he go, well, you must have said something. You know, I said, really? That's your response to that? You know, like, that's assault, you know? But in those days, you know, you didn't threaten lawsuits or whatever. You just dealt with it. I don't know if you know, Frank Tanana, is he from out here? Frank Tanana? So Frank Tanana was a pitcher, and I have to say I'm eternally grateful to him because it was in the middle of the locker room when Willie Hernandez, who was the pitcher, the guy, he dumped this bucket of water on me in the middle of the locker room, which wasn't very nice for the locker room attendants because they had to clean it all up. But the whole team, like, freezes, you know, like, what? And I'm standing there if you've ever had a bucket of ice water, if you ever took the ALS challenge or whatever, your body goes into shock for for a couple of seconds, and I'm standing there with all this ice dripping on me, and Frank Tanana, God bless him, he comes over to me and starts like, he leans in, he's just chit-chatting, he goes, just look at me and nod your head. Just look at me and nod your head, you know, just, we'll be talking like the, and he's, you know, moving his arm. And you could start to hear the locker room sort of return to their own conversations and what they're doing. And then finally, he looked around, he leaned into me, he said, you should probably go dry off now, you know. And so I went, and it became a big national story for a couple of days, and it was silly. But, you know, with regard to that in writing, I never felt that sports was a lesser than area to write in. Quite the contrary. I think if you look at some of the great writers of our time, many of them began in sports. Many of them did some of their best work in sports. If you've ever read Norman Mailer's essay on Muhammad Ali called Ego, it's one of the great pieces of writing, let alone sports writing. Tom Wolfe, when he went down and spent, you know, a month with the NASCAR kind of circuit, the race car took in North Carolina, brilliant pieces. And so you can do a lot of great writing in sports. And I tried to focus on the human sides of things. And I told you that story at dinner. I don't know if you want me to tell it again here, but
We're here to listen to you, man.
Well, I, as an example, and this is probably a piece that I would not have written, if I didn't have this sort of mentality when it came to sports. But I was at the Olympics, I think in Barcelona, I think it was 1992, and Carl Lewis, the sprinter, was supposed to run Saturday night in the 100-meter final. And that was the big story of that day in the Olympics, Carl Lewis going for another gold medal. So I went to the stadium early to try to beat the crowd because there were so many reporters and I wanted to get a good seat. So I ended up going at like 4 in the afternoon and the place was 2/3 empty and they were running like heats for some of the preliminary races. And there was a 400-meter heat, which is one lap around the track. And they shoot the gun off, it's like a, you know, quarterfinal. And after about 20, 30 yards, one of the runners pulls up lame, you know, pops a hamstring and drops to the track. Rest of the runners continue around and they qualify and they finish, but this guy is on the track and he's crying, you know, and he's in agony. And he stands up and he's holding his leg and he's in agony. And all of a sudden, this man runs out of the stands and comes onto the track and picks him up and lifts him and starts carrying him, walking him in the lane around the track. Now, if you step out of your lane, you have violated it and you're disqualified. So he was very careful to keep him in his lane and he starts walking him and he lifts him around like this and puts him on his feet and kind of walks his feet like this. And now the crowd that's there starts to notice this and begins to sort of clap, 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 clap. And eventually they make it around the bend and the athlete is crying and the man behind him is crying and they're walking and they're making sure not to do it. And they finally get across the finish line. And everybody claps. And I run downstairs, and there were only a handful of reporters there, and maybe five, and we run downstairs, and we find this athlete and this guy. And I was actually more interested in who it was that ran out onto the stands. And we find him, and I say, who are you? He says, I'm his father. And I said, why did you do that? He said, well, I knew that if he didn't finish, his name would never be in the record books as having participated. So he had to get across the line, but I knew he couldn't get out of the thing. So I couldn't bear as a father to watch him crying and suffering. So I ran down there and I said, well, why did you put him the way that you did hold him? He said, well, I taught him how to run when he was a little baby boy. And that's how I taught him, was to put him on my feet. I'm choking up. There's something about that image of a father, you know, teaching a child how to run, and then in his most dire moment as a young man, coming and saving him and doing the same thing. And I ended up telling my editors, I called them, I said, I'm not going to write this Carl Lewis story. I got a better story. And they said, how could you have a better story? It's Carl Lewis. It's the biggest story of the Olympics. I said, just trust me. And I wrote that story from the heart, and it became one of the things that, you know, when people look at my sports writing, whatever, they always pull that one out, and it's been sent around the country and won awards and all this stuff. But it was the instinct to say, I don't care who the star is, nothing is bigger than the emotion of, you know, parenting a child. And that's the story that people will relate to, far more than a guy who can run in 9.9 seconds. None of us can relate to that, but we can all relate to that story about teaching our children to run. And so, you know.
So many big themes that go through not only your sports writing, but in your novels. In your most recent novel, The Little Liar, your narrator isn't a character. Your narrator is a concept. It's the truth. The truth is telling a story. And I just was fascinated on how did you arrive at that point of view. Not to say this, you know, so there's character development. You know, I write, you write, we know how to develop characters. But a concept was communicating. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, I always say when you write a novel, the most important thing that you want to come up with at the beginning is the voice. Who's going to tell the story? Imagine Catcher in the Rye told in the third person. Would never work, right?
Right?
You had to have Holden Caulfield telling you that story with that language and the way that he talked, right? So The Little Liar, which is based on it was inspired by a true events during the Holocaust when Jewish prisoners who were taken by the Germans were brought to the train tracks to get on trains to go to the concentration camps. And they were tricked into getting into these trains because the Nazis would capture Jewish families or individuals, and they would threaten to kill their families if they didn't stand on the tracks and lie to their own people about, get in the trains, they're safe, they're going to new jobs, we're going to the east, they used to say, or to the north, and there's going to be jobs and homes. And so they got people to get into these trains who otherwise, you know, why would you get into a train that's going to a concentration camp? You might as well die on the tracks, right? And so I had heard about this concept, and I always wanted to do something with that because I thought forcing people to lie to their own people, it's so awful. But when I got the idea that a little boy, what if it was a little boy who had never told a lie before, and that's why people trusted him, and they kidnapped his family, and they said, you know, you go out and do this, or, you know, or else. And so he tells the first lie of his life, not realizing it's a lie. And he leads all these people into the, you know, almost to their slaughter. So you have a very heavy concept like that. But when I thought about the Holocaust, then I thought, well, what was really the victim, you know, besides the obvious victims who died, what was the conceptual victim of the Holocaust? And it was the truth. Because Hitler and the Nazis did not do what they did because they had bigger guns. They were able to do what they did because they had bigger lies. And they lied to their own people. They lied to the world. And people believed them, you know? Even in the early stages, the Jewish people kept believing, well, it can't be this bad. I mean, they tell us it's just going to be temporary. It's just for this. And so when I had that in mind, I thought, well, third person, yeah, you know, it's kind of dispassionate. First person, well, I had four characters. So if I tell one in the first person, what do I do with the other three? And then I sat down and I wrote this page, which I can, you have the little liar?
Yeah, right there.
Oh, there it is. I see all my books here. This is nice.
Yes.
It's like Amazon. Yeah. So. Yeah. I sat down and I wrote this pretty early in the process, and this was out of the blue. You can trust the story you're about to hear. You can trust it because I am telling it to you, and I am the only thing in this world you can trust. Some would say you can trust nature, but I disagree. Nature is fickle. Species thrive and then flame out. Others suggest you can trust faith. Which faith, I ask? As for humans, well, humans can be trusted only to watch out for themselves. When threatened, they will destroy anything to survive, especially me. But I am the shadow you cannot outrun, the mirror that holds your final reflection. You may duck my gaze for all your days on earth, but let me assure you, I get the last look. I am truth. And this is a story about a boy who tried to break me. And when I wrote that, I thought, okay, now I have the voice of this book. And once I had the voice of the book, the rest of the book was, I don't want to say it was easy, but it fell into place, because truth is able to say, when telling the story of the Holocaust and atrocities, look what you did to me. Truth gets to be indignant. A human being doesn't. First person does it. But truth says to me, how could you do this? Look at the price you paid. Look at what my little boy who never told a lie, my prize pupil, and you ruined him, you know? And so I got to be indignant about the Holocaust without me being indignant. But the concept was, and so it worked, you know, and that became, and that's why I say picking a voice for a book is everything, you know.
There's such a powerful line in there that's applicable to today, as that was. Here's the line: just as ignoring proper food will decay your body, so will hand-picking the truth eventually rot your soul. Were you thinking of this present age when you wrote that?
Yeah, unfortunately. you know, there was a lot of what goes on today in my thinking about how truth would speak. And even though truth is mostly in this book talking about the 1930s and 40s, it could absolutely apply today. And this is a very dangerous time that we live in, when, you know, truth is what you choose to make it. It can't be what you choose to make it, or it ceases to be the truth. And, you know, there's a parable that I did not invent. I was told this by a rabbi who I said, I'm writing this book about the truth. Do you know any good parables about the truth? You know, because every rabbi walks around with parables in his pocket, you know. And he said, oh, no, you know, just the one that everybody knows. I said, well, I'm not a rabbi. What's the one that everybody knows? And he said, well, you know about in heaven when God, you know, and the angel of truth. I said, no, tell me it. I said, so when God decided to create man, he gathered all the angels together to see if they thought it was a good idea. And the angel of righteousness said, yes, let man be created, for he will do righteous acts, you know. And the angel of mercy said, yes, let man be created, for he will be merciful, you know. Only the angel of truth said, no, do not create man, because he will be false and tell lies. And so what did God do? God took the angel of truth and cast him out of heaven and threw him down to earth. That was the parable. And I said, well, what does it mean? And he said, I don't know. But I took it and I added on my own interpretation. And I said, so God took the angel of truth, cast him out, and smashed him to earth. And in my version, it was, and he smashed into billions of pieces, each one finding a place inside the human heart. And there it lives or it dies. It's up to you to determine, you know. And that's where we are right now. Everyone knows the value of the truth intrinsically. We're taught it as children. But if you let it die in favor of your political party or your point of view or whatever it is, then you're killing truth, and you have that power. You know, sadly, we have the power to do that. So yes, I did sort of have that in mind, in today's world in mind, when I wrote that. And very sadly, if you want to talk about, you know, connection to today, when this book came out, it came out in November of 2023. And I ran into Anderson Cooper in New York about a week after it came out, and he's a friend of mine, and I don't know where I saw him, but he said, I read your book on the plane. I just came back from Israel. and this was a month after October 7th, he said, I can't believe the parallel of your book and the story about Tomer. Do you know that kid Tomer? I said, no, what is it? And he told me the story about, I think it was a 16-year-old boy named Tomer. And when Hamas came over the border and invaded the various villages and kibbutzes, one of the places they came to was a small little kibbutz, and they took this kid Tomer and his family, and they held him at gunpoint, and they told this kid, go around to every house in the kibbutz here and knock on the door and tell them in your voice that it's safe to come out, they're gone. If you don't do this, we're gonna kill your family. So he went from door to door, and when the people came out, they shot him. And then when he finished, they shot him too. And I said to myself, you know, you think as a writer that you can invent evil that's beyond, you know, real life. And then you find out that no, real life will always exceed the boundaries of what you think can happen. And so in many ways, this book has a lot of, you know, relevance that I did not intend. You know, I didn't see it coming, but it's there.
But we seem to keep making the same call of hatred and blame and fear from generation to generation. If we respect the truth so much as we say we do, why are we so fascinated with liars?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. And if we respect good so much, how come our favorite movies are about gangsters, you know? Like, there's some attraction to the bad, or at least we've created a society where, you know, I always listen to actors. I hope there aren't any. I know I'm in Southern California, but I was listening to actors say, you know, oh, it's so much more fun to play the villain. I love to play the villain. And I'm always like, why? You know, like, I always hate the villain, you know? I wanna like the hero, but I'm in the minority on that. I don't know the answer to that, Dean. Yeah. It's a good point.
Well, okay, so let's talk about another book. Let's talk about Finding Chica, which I just found a stunning story. You find a little girl in the orphanage in Haiti, you bring her back, you try to bring her back to the U.S., you try to help her. It's a very moving story, but here's one of the things I just so appreciated about it was the structure of it. So it's not just the story. The story is very moving, and you can tell a story better than anybody I know. But the structure of that book is so compelling to me. You don't bury the lead. You tell us right out front what happens to this little girl. She dies. And now we go back and forth where you're sometimes you're speaking to her, and sometimes you're just telling the rest of us a story. So I just want to know how you thought of framing this story.
Well, so thanks for saying that, first of all. I like to believe that Finding Chica is the finest book that I wrote, and I want to believe that because I want that to be my gift to our little girl. It was extraordinarily challenging to write that. First of all, I wanted to write it. So those of you who don't know, I'm making too many assumptions. I operate an orphanage in Haiti, many, many kids we take care of. One of them was born 3 days before the earthquake in 2010. On the third day of her life, she was on her mother's chest inside a one-room cinder block house, and the earth began to shake. The walls crumbled. The roof, because it wasn't detached, because most of them aren't in these shacks, is a piece of tin. It fell backwards, so the house collapsed, but they survived because the roof didn't come down on them, and they were all of a sudden, they were lying naked to the sky without a home. And that night, Chica was put in a bed of sugarcane leaves in the dirt, and that was her bed for the next 6 weeks. So she was born tough, and she would have to be tough. 2 years later, her mother died in that same rebuilt shack, giving birth to a baby brother, and she died because there was no doctor present. There was no doctor present because there's never a doctor present when poor people in Haiti give birth out in the provinces. You take your chances and you hope nothing goes wrong, and maybe you have a midwife or whatever, and something happened, and she bled out in the same bed that the baby was born, and she died in that same bed. And Chica was taken away, was brought to our orphanage when she was 2 and a half. And for the next 2 and a half years or so, she was the loudest, most obnoxious kid we have ever had at that orphanage. She yelled and screamed. She told every kid where they could go, what they could do. She was like Ethel Merman in size one shoes, you know. You could hear her voice from a mile away, you know. But that was just Chica. We just thought, oh, well, that's Chica. And so when she was 5, she developed a brain tumor. And we brought her to America thinking that, okay, whatever it is, the doctors will get it out and we'll get her back to Haiti. And then when they operated, they pulled my wife and I into a room and they said, you know, well, we found something that we didn't think we were going to find. This is something called DIPG, diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma. It's a four-letter word for death. It only strikes a few hundred kids a year, and only usually between ages 4 and 9, and it's always fatal. And usually the kids are gone within, you know, 4 to 8 months of discovery. And we're being told this all in a room, and so, you know, we thought we were going to be taking her back to Haiti. And all of a sudden, they're saying she's going to die on your watch. And so we said to the doctor, well, what would you do, you know, if it was your child? And he said, I would take her back to Haiti, and just she's going to die very soon, and just let her die quietly. At least she'll be home. And I remember looking at my wife, and she looked at me, and we both, you know, like that. And we said, you don't know this kid. She's a fighter. And if she's going to fight, we'll fight. So you better start telling us where the, you know, experimental treatments are, because we're not taking her back anywhere to die, you know, and we're not going to give up on her. And so that started this journey, which lasted not 4 months, like they predicted, not 8 months or 12 or 16 or 20, but 2 years. And she lived for 2 years as we traveled the world searching for a cure. And we lived in Cologne, Germany, for a stretch of time while we did immunization. We went to New York and stayed there while we did experimental stuff. And while we didn't find a cure in the end, we did find something that we didn't expect. We found a family. And Chica was just remarkable, funny and, you know, loud and battled through the whole thing. And, you know, she was, if I would sing, you know, she loved to sing, and I would play the piano, and then she would sing, and I would start to sing with her, and she put her hand over my mouth. Shut up, this is my act, you know, that kind of thing. One time, I remember I was coloring with her, and I looked at my watch, and this was late in the disease's progress, and she couldn't walk anymore, so I had to carry her wherever she went, you know, to the bedroom, to the bathroom, which was fine with her. She loved having a taxi service, you know, she was good with it. And I was coloring with her, and I looked at my watch. I was late for this radio show I did, and I popped up. I said, Chica, I gotta go. And she said, no, Mr. Mitch, stay, play with me. And I said, Chica, I have to work. And she said, Mr. Mitch, I have to play. And I said, yeah, but it's not the same thing, Chica, because this is my job. And she crossed her arms, you know, the way kids do, and pouted, and she said, no, it isn't. Your job is carrying me. You know? And, you know, I laughed at it, and then I, one of those things you realize you're never going to hear a truer sentence than that. Of course, my job was to carry her. And
it's kind of like that dad with that track star in Barcelona.
Yeah.
I mean, he was carrying his son there.
Exactly. That's why I can relate to that. I choke up when I tell that story, because, you know, my whole life up till that point, you know, I walk around, you're carrying your accomplishments, your book sales, your money, your awards, and then you have to drop all that and carry a 5 and 6 and 7 year old child who's dying, and there's no comparison. You know, it's one is an honor and the other is just hubris. And so we are what we carry, and we are defined by what we carry. And when she died, I wanted to write that book right away. And my publishers, actually, the only time in my career, they stopped me from writing a book, and they invoked the whatever the thing is in the contract, like, no. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, you're too upset. You're grieving too much. It won't come out the way you want it to. And I disagreed with them, but I had to do what they said based on the contract. So I wrote another book before that. And then when I sat down to write Finding Chica, I knew that the notion in the book world is nobody wants to read a book about a dying child. It's too hard. And I was determined to get people to read this book because it wasn't about her dying. It was about her living. And so I decided, okay, and everything that they said to me was, nobody wants to read a book where it's getting worse and worse and worse, and they know she's going to die at the end. They can't handle it. They just won't finish it. I said, fine. I'll tell them on the first page. So the way I wrote the book, Chica would come downstairs. I always had to take care of her in the morning. My wife would sleep a little longer. I'd take care of Chica in the morning, then we'd switch. So she'd come down to my office and sit by my feet and just play with things and whatever. And of course it was, all right, Chica, you can sit here, but Mr. Mitch has to write. So remember, no disturbing, just play, whatever. Okay, 5 seconds. Mr. Mitch, do you have a pen? Mr. Mitch, do you have some crayons? Mr. Mitch, do you have paper? You know, and it was always like that. So on the very first page of the book, I said, you know, I'm sitting by the computer and Chica, you know, who died, you know, is sitting next to me. She's come back. And she says, what are you doing? And I'm saying, I'm writing. What are you writing? A book. Well, why don't you write a book about me? And that's like the first page, you know? And so now you know she died, but you know she's coming back to talk to me, which used to happen to me all the time when I would sit there and look at the space where she used to sit. Of course, you just imagine, you know, what you would say to her and all that. And I wrote it that way, and I wrote it with a lot of humor and a lot of the joy that she had. And I ended it by saying, you know, we didn't lose a child, we were given one, which is the way that I look at it. And she was glorious. That was the last line of the book. And I managed to write a book about a child who dies without making it about the dying child, you know, and that's why I did it that way.
But writing this book made you physically ill. What's that about?
Well, what it's about is you have to relive everything that you already you thought you put away, and now you got to go through it again, and you got to look at all the pictures and the hospitalization, and, you know, you have to make sure you get your facts right because it's a nonfiction book, you know, you can't just make up stuff about a disease, and so you're talking to doctors and reliving it, and by the end, I didn't even realize what was going on with me, but I was like shaking, and I went to these neurologists. I had MRIs done. I thought I was having like strokes and stuff, and they said, you know, well, what are you doing? You know, I said, well, nothing. You know, I'm writing. Well, what are you writing about? I said, well, I'm writing about our little girl who died. Oh, do you drink coffee or anything? I said, yeah, but, you know, not that much. Well, how much? I had 9 or 10 cups a day. And they said, okay, wait a minute. You're drinking 9 or 10 cups of coffee a day, and you're writing about your child who died, and you want to know why you're having the shakes or something like that. Just go home and finish the book and stop drinking coffee, which I did both of those. I just have one cup here and there anymore, like I did today, but almost never drink any coffee anymore. So.
I'm sure I'm not the first one to point out that early in your career, you get this wisdom from a 78-year-old, and now in your career, you're getting all this wisdom from a 7-year-old. And they're both just really, really profound pieces of wisdom here. You've got this amazing kind of bookend thing going on here.
I do, and I have been blessed so much in my life to learn from people. And really, you know, like I always say about Tuesdays with Maury, I'm just the guy who carried the water in Tuesdays with Maury. Today when I visited with some of your students, one of them said, Maury, can I ask you a question? I said, I'm not Maury, I'm the stupid one, remember? But it's not the first time that that happens.
Really, they call you Maury.
It happens all the time. People, Maury, can I ask you a question? And I absorbed Maury, I absorbed Chica. I've been blessed to have people around me whose lessons I've absorbed and been able to put onto the page. And I want to say, God is magnificent in God's unique way of handling balance in your life if you live long enough. And 3 years ago, we were at the orphanage, and a woman brought by a baby. She had five kids. She wanted to give us all five of her kids. We said, we can't take five children. But there was a baby who was 6 months old and only weighed 7 pounds. And the mother said, I don't have any food to give any of my kids. This baby has only had sugar water since she's been born. I don't know how a baby lives on sugar water for 6 months. But she was emaciated. There was nothing to her. Her eyes were closed from conjunctivitis. You could lift, you know, fit her in one hand. And so we raced her. We managed to get back. The embassy was still open back then, and we managed to get a visa for her very quickly and get her to America because we knew she had to go on this special nutrition program to try to save her life. And we bought her home, and we, my wife and I, took care of her around the clock. Every 2 hours, you have to feed every 2 hours, you know, 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock, all like that. And it has to go on for months. You can't overload the child with food. And we would bring her to the doctor, and the doctor would say, I don't know what to tell you. Like, we say, well, is she going to be okay? He says, we don't see children who haven't eaten anything but sugar water in America. We don't have any basis. He said, just love her, feed her, and pray. And it turns out, you know, that love, food, and prayer are a pretty lethal combination. Well, not lethal, pretty positive combination. And she began to thrive, and opened her eyes. She began to make noise. Of course, her first words were Dada, you know. And there came a point where, I don't know, I looked at Janine and I said, you know she's never going home, right? And she said, yeah, I know. And now it's been 3 years, and we are blessed with the most magnificent little daughter who is just so cute and so smart. So, and we have pictures of Chica, you know, of course, around the house. And she says, and we say, who's that? And she says, that's Chica. And I said, who's Chica? My sister, you know? And so it's funny how that all works around, you know?
You've connected some really powerful dots here.
Yeah.
Really, really powerful.
The dots, if you get to live long enough, you start to figure out how these dots are connected. You know, I didn't realize when I wrote Five People You Meet in Heaven, I was a kid. You know, I wrote that book because I didn't want to write any more nonfiction after Tuesdays with Maury, because I thought it's just going to be, whatever it is, it's going to pale in comparison. It took me 6 years to write another book after Tuesdays with Maury because everybody just wanted Wednesdays with Maury, you know, and Chicken Soup with Maury and Venus and Mars and Maury and, you know, more Maury, you know, or my favorite, Things I Forgot Maury Told Me, you know. And so I knew that whatever I did, they were going to say, well, it's not Maury. So I said, well, let me just write a novel, you know. And my idea for a novel was about an old man who dies thinking that he's a nobody and goes to heaven and finds out that the first stage of heaven, you meet five people from your life, some of whom you knew well, some of whom might have been complete strangers, but they affected you in some way, and you changed their life, and they changed yours. And by the end of the five people, he finds out that he affected so many people in his life. And that idea that heaven is not floating on clouds and harps and all that. Heaven is where you finally get to understand what happened down here. That's a heavenly concept. I am now, as I'm getting older, realizing that that's the most blessed thing that you can have happen to you here on earth, is to start to connect the dots of your life and saying, so that's why that happened. Mm-hmm. And that's why mm-hmm. that happened. And I thought this was the worst thing. How many people, you say to yourself, when it happened, I thought it was the worst thing that was going to happen. Now that I look back on it, it was kind of the best thing that could have happened. Well, if it's the best thing that could have happened now, it was the best thing that could have happened then. We just didn't have enough perspective on life to understand it then, right? And that's what we get as we get older. That's the gift of age, I find.
So what are you working on now?
I just finished a book last week. So yes, I'm very happy, yeah. So after writing The Little Liar, I really did not want to do something heavy like that. That was a very, very difficult book to, I think it's the best novel I've written.
It's marvelous.
Thank you, that's very kind of you.
It really
is. But I worked really hard in it. I wanted there to be one, I wanted to contribute one book at least in my career to the literature of the Holocaust, because I think it's very, very important that we don't forget it. And we recognize that it can happen again. And God, if you look across the landscape, you know. But I didn't want to write a book that had been done before, you know. There are so many great books about the Holocaust, don't get me wrong, but I didn't want to write another, you know, the fill in the blank of Auschwitz, the tattooist, the barber, the librarian, the, you know. So I was waiting for an idea to come hit me, and when that did, I really threw myself into it. I researched, I went to Thessalonica, you know, everything in there is factually correct, except the fictional characters, but even the house. If you go to Thessalonica and look up that address, it looks just like that, and it was a house during World War II. And I couldn't do that again. It was so draining. So I wanted to do something a little more whimsical. So anyhow, the book is called Twice, and its concept is that there's this guy who discovers he has the magical ability when he's a kid to do everything in his life twice. He can go back and change anything, but he has to live with the consequences of the second try. He can't go back to the first one if it was better. So he spends his youth, you know, kind of correcting his mistakes, and when he twists his ankle, he just goes back and doesn't fall, and, you know, and then when he's a teenager, he tries to correct all the embarrassing adolescent mistakes, whatever. And then he gets older and he falls in love, and he finds out, I don't want to give too much away, but he finds out that there's one caveat to the power. If you go back and undo a love, thinking, you know, maybe you can do better, or you want to try somebody else, that person can never love you again, no matter what. And, you know, they'll be in the world, but no matter what you do, they can never love you again. And of course, he thinks he finds this perfect girl, and they're going along, and then something changes in the relationship, and he has to make that decision, which you can probably already guess what he does, and then you know, it's what happens. So it's a book about, you know, the grass is always greener kind of idea. But I have met a lot of people who have said, man, if I could just do that over again, I would do this, and things would be so much better. And of course, we don't realize that if we could do everything over again, we wouldn't learn anything. You know, like, it's your mistakes that kind of teach you the direction that you take. So this lead character, until he kind of realizes what he did wrong, is kind of, you admire him, but you also like, wait a minute, it's not fair. He's getting to fix everything. So it was fun to write, and it was much lighter than this, and it really deals with love. It's a book about love, you know, and I've written about a lot of subjects, but what really is the truth about true love? And so hopefully there's a lot of people who are into romance kinds of stories and things like that these days. It's not quite a bodice ripper, you know, but...
That's coming, though.
Yeah, that's not really my thing. I just learned what a bodice was last year, so.
I've got the title, Finding Bodice.
Or Unfinding the Bodice.
Yeah.
But it was fun to write, and it has a kind of a thriller element to it. The book starts with this guy when he's old, and he's arrested in the islands in a casino where they charge him with hitting three straight numbers at a roulette table on the exact number. And of course, nobody could do that. And he's being interrogated by a cop. And the cop says, you know, come on, tell me how you did it. Tell me how you did it. So finally, he pulls a notebook out of his bag, which says, to be read upon my death. And he says, here, read this, and you'll understand what happened. And he says, what is it? He says, it's a love story. And through this kind of notebook telling back and forth between the cop interrogating him, and it's a little like Slumdog Millionaire, you know, like they go to the investigation and that, and you kind of find out his life story. And so hopefully, you know, I'll come back when it comes out and we'll talk about it again if you want.
You will be back.
Yeah, okay, cool.
So let's... Two quick questions and then we're out. A lot of people here are writers. Give us your best writing advice.
Okay, I'll repeat a story that I told a little earlier today. When I was first starting out in writing, I interviewed a photographer, a very, very successful photographer of his day, and I asked him how he became such a good photographer, how he learned his art. And he said, well, when he was young, when he was my age, he wanted to, you know, learn everything he could, and there was a really famous photographer of his day. So he took the pictures that he had taken and he sent them off to this guy with a letter, please help me, you know, I'm starting out, can you give me any advice? A few months later, he got his photos back with a note. And the note said, it's obvious from your photographs that you've mastered the basics of photography. Now, go out and surround yourself with the best music, the best writing, the best art, and everything else will take care of itself. And what he meant by that was that, you know, if you surround yourself with influences that you can absorb from the artistic world, it doesn't have to be writing. It can be music. It can, you know, I can't tell you how many music things have inspired me to write. I wrote a whole book about music. And it can be dance. It can be a movie. It can be, but if you surround that and let that osmosis kind of get into you, you know, you will find that you have creativity stirred inside of you. I, again, mentioned this earlier today. I try to read books of writers that I admire. I don't care if they're fiction or nonfiction. I want to read their craft. I want to see what other people who I admire are doing. And I underline them and highlight them. And then when the book is over, I go through them, or my assistant now helps me, and we pull all these lines that I underlined as examples of great writing or phrases or turn of a phrase or a paragraph or a way a character was described or something. And I just print them out on page after page after page after page. And I have them in a file called Words. And whenever I just want to begin to think about a new book, or maybe I hit a snag in the writing, you know, where I'm going, I just open it up and just start reading these selected sentences from hundreds of different books that I've read, just examples of wonderful writing. And they inspire me. You know, you read a sentence, you go, yeah, I see what he did there. I see what she did there. I could do that. I could do that. And you start to get yourself going. So surround yourself with great writing, great art, whatever, and let it get into you. You know, that's the best advice that I can give you. There's a million sort of, well, here's a tip about how to write this kind of paragraph, and here's what you do when you're dealing with the first person, and here's how you develop a plot and all that. But, you know, there are many books on that kind of thing, and I think that people sort of teach themselves that anyhow. But that's the first thing. And the second thing is treat it like a job. Do not act like the movies where, you know, someone's sleeping in bed and all of a sudden there's a crack of lightning, they wake up, they pop out of bed and they go, oh my God, I got an idea for a novel. And they sit down and they start typing, and 4 days later, you know, with bags under their eyes, they pull a novel out of their typewriter and they go, you know, I was just inspired. It never happens that way. Never. Anybody I know who's worth their salt treats writing like the job that it is. They get up every day and they go to the lumber yard, you know. They go and they work at it. And some days are better than others. And I would recommend, don't quit when it's going badly. Quit when it's going well, because that way you'll want to get up tomorrow morning and do it again. I personally don't write longer than maybe 2.5 hours a day. But I do it the very, very beginning of the day. As soon as I get up and brush my teeth, grab a cup of coffee, or now it's like herbal tea, disgusting. But it is hot and it gives you something to drink. And then I just sit down and start writing. I don't read anything else. I don't turn on the news. I don't want anything in my head. I just want an empty head and sit down and just start writing. And usually about 2.5 hours later, I can kind of feel like the gas is out of the tank. And if that's the case, that's fine, you know, but I do it every day. I do it on Saturdays, I do it on Sundays, you know, I do it every day and I treat it like a job. And most of the The writers in that band that I told you about, they do the exact same thing. You know, Elmore Leonard, who was a friend of mine who lived in Birmingham, Michigan, right from a couple miles from my house, he actually had a little office. Even though he had a beautiful house and a place to write, he had an office that was a couple blocks away, and he would get up, dressed, go out of his house, go down a couple blocks, go into the office, and sit there at 9 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock. 9 to 5, 9 to 5, which is a very Detroit thing to do if you really think about it, but that's how he treated it, you know, and he stayed in there and just slogged at it, and he produced many, many great books and wonderful writing. So those are the two things that I would...
That's great advice. So Maury, in Tuesdays with Maury, described his perfect day. What's your perfect day?
Well, Maury, remember, Maury was unable to move at the time that I asked him that question, and he was facing his mortality. So Maury answered that question by saying, you know, I would walk, and I would enjoy nature, and I would have a lovely meal, and I would have friends over, and we would all talk about how we love each other and all that. And then at night I would go dancing, and then I would fall into a beautiful sleep. And of course, when I said to him, that's so ordinary, and he said, that's the point. I would echo that, but I have to say that I wouldn't want, you know, I don't want to jet away to the Mount Everest or do some kind of, I just want to be with the people that I love, and eating would be fine, but I want children to be with me. I have, as I've gotten older, adults make less and less sense to me, and children make more and more, and it's weird because we didn't have children, my wife and I. We got married pretty late, and we tried, and it didn't happen, and we just kind of figured that's what it's going to be. And yet, in our 50s, children started to become a huge part of our life, and then Chica came in, and now little Nadi, and I get so much joy. I took Nadi to the beach yesterday, because we don't have beaches in Detroit, so I came out here, and that was the first thing we did, you know, like, okay, let's go to a beach, and just watching her run down to the waves, and then the waves start coming up, and we have to run backwards, and then we run down, and then we run backwards. It's such a joy that to have this and to be gifted this at my age, that my perfect day would have to include that. But I will, if we're wrapping up, may I tell one story to wrap up?
Yeah.
Because you asked me about Maury. So let me end this. I know it's about writing, but I do think that
it's
writing
about you, man. We're trying to celebrate.
Well, I'm not
you
that
as a storyteller.
But I think what Maury had to say is interesting. And I do think how you write reflects how you live. So on my last visit with Maury, you know, Maury always wanted to be in his chair in his office. And so he would always have someone carry him out and put him in his chair. Because he used to say, if you're in bed, you're dead. So he didn't want to be in bed. And on the last day I came in to see him, I went to his office, which is what I always did, and there was nobody there. So I walked back two doors and looked in the bedroom, and he was in bed. So I knew that we were down to the end, and I went over and sat down, and I you know, always had to hold his hand, and you know, I'm holding his hand, and he said to me, I want to ask you a favor. I said, okay, anything. He said, after I die, I want you to come to my grave and visit me. I said, okay, I was going to do that anyhow. And he said, well, not the way everybody else comes. Don't come in your car and get out and leave the engine running and put down some flowers and get back in the car and go. I want you to come when you have some time. Bring a blanket, bring some sandwiches, and I want you to talk to me about your life, about your problems, you know. And I said, wait a minute, you want me to come to a cemetery, have a picnic at your tombstone, and talk to the air. And he said, exactly, just like we're talking now. And I said, well, Maury, it's not going to be like we're talking now, because let's face it, you're not going to be able to talk back. And he looked at me as if I were being very naive, and he said, well, Mitch, I'll make you a deal. After I'm dead, you talk, I'll listen. And I laughed too. But when I sat down to write Tuesdays with Maury, after he died, just 3 days after that, I had the tape of that last conversation, and I would listen to it over and over again. And I realized that that wasn't an accident, that he waited until the end to tell me that you talk, I'll listen line, because in it is everything that he was really trying to teach me, and everything that I have was tried to get across in Tuesdays with Maury, and have tried to get across in every book that I have written since, which I always say, if you just look, even cursory glance, you will see a piece of Tuesdays with Maury in every single book that I write after it. And that is this: if you spend your time with people, as he did, making time for people, giving of yourself for other people, then when you die, you're not 100% gone. You live on inside the heads and the hearts of everybody you touched. And you can talk to them, and they can talk to you, not because they believe in seances or whatever, but because you spent time putting your voice inside them. It's like a penny in a piggy bank, I always say. You know, you put a penny in a piggy bank, you can't see it anymore, it's gone forever, you're never going to touch it again. For all intents and purposes, it's dead to the world, right? But you take the piggy bank, and there it is, right? And that's how we live on. That's how Maury said, death ends a life, but not a relationship. The relationship can go on, but you have to invest in those relationships when you're here if you expect them to go on. You can't be like me in the 16 years between graduating and going back to see Maury, which everybody seems to forget about when they're always complimenting me on, oh, it was so great what you did with your professor. Yeah, what about the 16 years that I ignored him? That wasn't so great. That wasn't good at all. If you want yourself to go on, you have to invest in those relationships while you're here, you know? It's like a stone in a pond, ripples and ripples and ripples and ripples. And if you don't think that that's true, or you think it's a corny way to wrap up a corny anecdote, then honestly, look around. Why are you here? Why are you listening to me? You don't know me personally, and you didn't know Maury, and you didn't know Chica. They weren't rich, they weren't famous. One was just an old man who spent time while he was dying with a wayward student to pass on his lessons. One was a little girl who had no idea the influence she would have. But they didn't even know about books. Maury never read one word of Tuesdays with Maury. Not one. But look how large his classroom has grown. How many of you are here because of Tuesdays with Maury? Mm-hmm. Most of you probably, or at least in some small way. Look at the influence he's having for someone who's not even here to teach the class. That book is in Spanish and Swedish and Swahili and languages I can't even understand. And he's not even here. That's the effect we have. One life touches another and touches another and touches another. And that's the message that I wrote at the end of my first novel, Five People You Mean Heaven. And that's the lesson I still live by today. You know, so if my writing can affect anybody, and they tell a story, or you go home from this thing tonight, you remember one thing I said, and you share it with somebody else and share it with somebody, then I've done something, you know? And when you all write, you'll do the same thing, you know? This is how we live on, by the people that we touch and the people who touch us. So that's all I have to say.
We started out this conversation talking about music. Could you play something for us?
Okay, but no Elvis. All right, you want me to play one little song?
I do.
One little song. Okay, remember, this isn't what I do anymore.
It is now. Mitch Album.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.